I am Clement O. Humphreys. I presently reside in Dunbar, West Virginia. On Easter Sunday, April 5, 1942, as a soldier in the 18th Engineer Combat Regiment, I left Vancouver Barracks with the regiment. Our destination was White Horse, Yukon Territory. Our purpose was to build a section of the Alcan Highway from White Horse to the Alaskan border. We boarded railroad cars near Vancouver Barracks and traveled to Prince Rupert, British Columbia, where we traveled first-class tourist boats to Skagway. We had to wait 2 weeks in Skagway for the White Pass to open. What a thrill it was to stand where Soapy Smith had been shot, and then to take time to have time to explore around Skagway, where the Great Gold Rush took off. Then to cross the mountain range and see Lake Bennett and follow the river down the way the gold rushers had traveled, and to see the White Horse Rapids and made famous by Robert W. Service and Jack London. I'm now going to talk about photographs which were taken along the Alcan Highway during the time the 18th Engineers worked there. As you know, that was 50 years ago, and I'll be talking from pictures and from memory. I'm not sure that I'll be accurate. I'll do my best to be truthful and correct. The first few pages in this album are pictures that I bought, and they are annotated right on the picture if for anyone who wishes to see them. I now come to the page I've numbered one in the album, where the pictures taken by members of the regiment were snapped. First, I might comment that you'll see as many pictures of equipment which is stuck in the muskeg along the highway or along the route of the highway. I assume there are two reasons for this. One is that a vehicle operating and sitting up high and dry is of little interest in a picture. The other is that somebody had to be out front. So you see in at the top of the page a D4 and an 80 wagon stuck deep in the quagmire. Evidently, they went ahead of where the D8s had started to grade. The next picture, that where it looks like a ladder, is the leads of a pile driver. The interesting thing about it was that, of course, all the bridges had to be placed on wooden pile, and the problem was getting the pile through the permafrost. I saw them try putting a steam jet down by the point of the pile and try to soften the permafrost. But it appears that the best solution to that was to put a metal point on the pile and then drive it through the permafrost. And now we see another stuck D4. The next picture, where you see three GIs, and in the background dimly you see a truck cab. This truck hauled an air compressor which furnished the power for the saws you see being used in the lower right hand picture. The air compressor worked fine where when you could get the air to the place where the job needed to be done. You You know, of course, we didn't have gasoline saws or electric saws in those days. So the use of the air compressor made the sawing much easier than it was when you used a two-man crosscut saw. Well, here you see another set of pile driver leads and a D8 really clearing out the road. I have no idea what that man-made crib is in front of the D8 blade there. Page 2, there's the airplane land on Lake Kalani on pontoons. That's the mail plane, and when the mail plane came, we dropped everything and ran to the first sergeant's tent. In this picture, you see the real work being done. You can see exactly that D8 is just pushing the trees over and pushing them out of the way while the two men in front do whatever is necessary to keep the thing going. Now, the wrecked plane on the riverbank, I've been told that plane was on the way into the company to carry out a man who needed to go to the hospital back at the base in White Horse. I know that we were working nearby. I have no idea the name of that stream. I do know that one of the soldiers who got down there first tried to swim across to the plane and got into trouble and was floundering around out there. And as luck would have it, one of the men who came down to look at the crash had been working somewhere with ropes. And he had a rope with him, threw it out to the guy, and dragged him in. By that time, the first sergeant was tired of the excitement and put us back to work. You see a shovel with a dipstick on it, loading sand and gravel into those trucks. And of course, the gravel that covered the highway was secured in this manner. Just some more equipment there, but on the right-hand corner, lower corner, you see one of the 6x6s dragging a small truck through the mud. And you can tell here that there's been no gravel applied to the road. You just see that it's been cleared out. On page 3, we come down to the picture of the boat. Those boats were used around on Kalani there. I never had any opportunity to be in one of them, and I don't know really what they were used for. In the center picture, you see the ingenuity of the American GI, where they built this form out of timber secured nearby, build it up high enough so like an underpass so a truck could pull under there, left the hole in the top of it, then shove gravel up to make a ramp on each side so that a D4 tractor could go right up there and shove gravel out on the top of that structure, let it fall through a hole into the bed of the truck to save lots of time. And again, you see what the road was like when they were first just running tractors over it to get a grade. In the lower picture, another picture of the highway, apparently in better condition. And of course, you see that we had our artillery along. Page 4, I believe, needs no comment. Page 5, the upper picture shows what the trace was like before there was any grading done. That's exactly the way it was when we went out of White Horse. And the lower corner shows the beginnings of a bridge. You can see that it's made entirely of logs gathered nearby, and it's the way the bridges were made. The pictures on page 6 need very little comment, except to say that you can see that the center picture on the right has a ponton bridge alongside the structure of the new bridge. The picture of interest on page 7 is the one showing a piece of heavy equipment being moved across one of the bridges built by the GIs, which goes to show that they would stand up. The shot in the lower right-hand corner on page 8 is Burwash Landing, where there was a trading post in existence when we were there. I'm sure that he was an outfitter because he had several horses, which we'll tell you about later. On page 9, you can see the pictures that shows the way that we crossed the streams and the lakes as we traveled early in the early part of the highway. On page 10, it shows some of the places that we bivouacked. One in the first picture was taken from high up on the mountain. You can see the rows of tents and little dots there, and that's the way the rivers looked from far away, when especially the ones that were running low and shallow. They had many sandbars and small streams rather than one large stream of water. The picture of the double bunks there, these ingenious GIs had cut poles and built the bunks to put their bedrolls on. And as I remember, they didn't get up when we were breaking camp there one morning, and so they took the tent down and left the beds standing, and of course the GIs came back and got their equipment later. The log buildings, we were told, was the remains of an old copper mine. The fly tent that you see in the lower left, and of course it's always a stack of wood. We had everything we heated, we did with wood. That's the mess tent at that particular time. And then the middle picture there in the bottom is also part of the food preparation. You can see two cooks or two KPs under the fly here, ready to serve the chow. All the things were cooked in those big aluminum pots or pans like that, and the cooks sometimes were careless and would stick whatever they were cooking, especially that steak and gravy, they called it, and it took hours to scrape that stuff out of those pots. And finally, a company commander cured that by issuing an order that any cook that let a pan stick had to clean it. Page 11, the top two are more bivouac areas. And then, in the middle row, the wooden barracks, which were built, as you can see, it was very cold before we, part of us, got into those barracks. And of course, they were usually too hot, and so you can't have anything exactly right when you're soldiering. The next is a sawmill. A portable sawmill, and that's where the lumber came from to build those permanent buildings. And then you'll see an interesting story there. A moose stretched across the hood of a Jeep. One of the men, who shall remain nameless, shot that moose out of season and was duly fined by the Canadian government a goodly sum. Of course, being resourceful, he placed a tin cup on the table where those pots you saw back there were sitting, and let anybody that wanted to chip in to help him pay his fine. The result of that was that they took our rifles from us and did what they call stacking, and so nobody was able to go out in the woods armed. Incidentally, I think all the GIs were glad that that they didn't allow cooks to go out and kill the game that they served to the men, because that moose was absolutely impossible to eat. And I've understood that moose is a very good meat if it's prepared correctly. On page 12, I believe this to be the house of a Caucasian gentleman who lived near Lake Kalani. He had two daughters who were away to school, but they came back during the summer, and believe me, that was off limits to any GI. Here's my friend Nelson, who later in this taping will describe the celebration of the dedication of the highway. He's using a drawer knife to flatten the top of a log, and of course I don't know what it's going to be used for at that time. The next there is something that is really remarkable. That you see is a shower house, a laundry house, and there on top of that tower that we built is a holding tank to hold the water that operates there. And you can see a little bit of the hot water tank on the left, but there's a better picture of it later. You see the barracks bags full of clothes there and the inevitable sack of wood. The company commander allowed two men to do nothing but do laundry, and each GI paid $2 a bag for his laundry, which was a good deal. But one thing that they forgot was how the glaciers were formed, because when it got cold, they had a lot of these barracks bags on the floor of that building. The donjack began to freeze, and the warm water would run out and freeze, and more water would run out and freeze on top of that, until one day, after two or three days of not being down to see about the clothing, these boys went down and found that those barracks bags were frozen fast in the ice, and you couldn't get you couldn't rescue anything out of that without tearing it up. So everybody had to sign papers and go and get a new issue of whatever clothing was in that barracks bag. Some people suggested that the GIs ought to have to pay for them, but I think that the idea died rather suddenly. The lower right-hand picture is just another picture of the shower and water tank. Incidentally, there was an article in the November 1943 National Geographic. The author of this article had visited our company more than once and used that shower and had meals with us. He was full of praise for that, and this article reminded me of something that I had forgotten, and that was how dusty those highways became during the summer. It would choke you to ride in a truck if there's another vehicle in front of you. Here's a building left by some long forgotten trapper or copper miner or gold miner. And we don't know really what it is. And in the center picture on the left is the best fish fryer that ever was. And the man on the right is Nelson, who, as I say, has a part in this taping. There you see the beginnings of the permanent barracks. The men are getting ready to put the roof on. Down below, there's that water heater, the tank that I was telling you that the boys built. They could do just about anything in their shops. And that's one of the things. One of the things I might mention here was that long after we left the Yukon, we got out in the islands, I went to the dentist, and he had an electric drill, the first one I ever saw, and it had, he said, had been built by one of the men in the automotive shop. The tent there is of special interest. That's the tent in which I lived, and Peabody, the old regular Army sergeant, had selected three West Virginia hillbillies to stay with him on that highway, and I suppose he thought we might know how to work or would work, maybe better than the city boys. But the tent is of interest because when the weather began to get cold, we four built a form to put the tent on, but we went out to the road, and there was a seam in the cut in the road that looked, we called it fly ash. You couldn't hold it any place. It was so light. We put it in sacks and hauled it there and put it on down and made a floor out of it, then put slabs over that. Then we took slabs and built a wall in that tent up to as long as it's vertical. And then where the perimeter starts, we took our shelter as and put a ceiling in there. Then somebody in the tent stole a 5-gallon gasoline can, and somebody stole some copper with a petcock, and somebody stole some diesel and put in that can, and they set that petcock so that it would just drip fast on the wood that we put in the stove, and we really had a nice warm tent as long as you were inside. Now I've seen fellows like would come in from a line company for some reason and have to put up a tent, and they'd have a stove in their tent and plenty of wood and all of that, but the frost would never go out from under the spot where they put their beds. On page 14 are scenes from White Horse, and I assume that you can interpret those as well as I can, because I have no memory of them. However, I do think the totem pole was at Prince Rupert. On page 15, we have a real picture of drying fish somewhere along the highway. These do not resemble much the commercial picture, which I have, that will show up later in this book. I do remember this cemetery just outside White Horse, because I never knew what the reason was, but I was impressed by the fact that each one had a little house over the grave. In fact, since I didn't get to ask anybody about the graves or about the fish, I'd say here that I can't recall that I spoke with anyone other than a serviceman in the months that I was in on that White Horse or Alcan Highway, except that I did hear a native, an apparent Indian, talk about bears and the fact that one should not run from a bear. But I want to tell you that I ran from a bear. Peabody and I had hiked back to the head of Christmas Creek and over on the other side and built a raft. And then we were going to fish, but we didn't have time that time. This happened to be around June 21st when the sun went down around the end of the mountain, and an hour later it was right back up. We went back the next weekend, and while I was down in the in the brush, walking behind, a good way behind Peabody, smoking my pipe and enjoying life, I heard a sound that sounded like a male hog, and he says, and I looked, and there came a bear. So I took off, I ran and yelled for Peabody to wait, because if I was going to get chewed, I wanted somebody to be chewed along with me. But it just happened that he was standing in a clear place, and he said when I made the clearing, the bear made it right behind me, reaching for me, and then it stopped suddenly and then began to circle us, and every once in a while they'd come in and stand up in the clear place, and we made an agreement that if it charged, one of us would run one direction, one would run the other, and the one that didn't get caught would go back to camp and bring help to bring in the remains of the guy that was left there. On pages 19, 20, 21, 22, you'll see a set of miscellaneous pictures that just shows the country, and there isn't anything specific to talk about except that those white streaks in pictures that you see is actually a river like the Donjack or like the Skagway, where there's small streams of water coursing around bars in the riverbed. And then on page 24, the lower right, is an island, and that is an island in Kalani Lake. Page 25 and 26 are a continuation of a collection of miscellaneous pictures, except that the one in the lower right is actually the cliff at the docks in Skagway. And as usual, you people have gone up there and put their fraternity symbols and I love you and AA loves BV and so on. Now, on page 27, you'll see the man on the horse is Clement O. Humphreys, the guy that's doing the talking here. The story about that horse was that the Army rented some horses from Jocko and had three of us take them up to the head of the line for the officers and the surveyors to use when they went further up in the country. The picture in the upper left, the man there is Clem Humphreys, and after I went out into the Aleutians, I became a shovel operator, a dragline operator, pile driver operator, crane operator, any kind of operator that went with that type of machine. On page 30, it might be of interest to anybody looking at this to see four pictures of Japanese equipment that was left on one of the islands, either probably Kiska or maybe Attu. Now we come to album 2, page 1. The man in front of the tent with the string of fish is again Humphreys. The two men in front of the tent, Sergeant Peabody and Humphreys, trying to take a fish rod apart. And then there's some guys showing off, holding their rifles. This picture of the two men in the brush there, I think it's part of going up on the mountain where we built the cairn, and because we felt we were the first people at the top of the mountain. And I believe that one of those men backed out and went back to camp. The others are just pictures of GIs. On page 2, you see a picture of the band, and I'd like now, if there's any of the members of that band that ever hear what I'm saying, to say how much they helped and how much we enjoyed and appreciated their efforts to entertain us. How many mornings I woke up to the sound of, "Please don't sit under the apple tree." Again, you can put your own interpretation on what you see here on page 3, except in the lower right there, the truck driver that's supposed to pick up this work detail, of which I was one, is late, and there's old Peabody checking his pocket watch. The only thing I see of note on this upper line there is that man sitting out in front in the middle picture. He made some remark about that moose, and that's why I remember that we had just finished trying to eat that moose there that day. And he made a remark, which is unprintable, that I'll never forget. Of course, you see the great chow line, and again, you see some entertainment going on, and there the man lying stretched out there in a rock bed is one of the men, is the man who went with me to the top of that mountain, where you see, if you turn this album so that the rifles are pointing up, that's a rock cairn in which we built on top of that mountain and put our names and addresses in a can, so that if anybody ever went up there, they might write to us. And as yet, I haven't heard. I wonder if anybody ever did go up to the top of that mountain. And there's more entertainment there by the band. Here it's just GIs and maybe some of these pictures you've seen before, except we have a girl there. You see the girl in the hula scoop in the middle picture? Not in a scoop, in a skirt. That was one of the band members, a female impersonator he was, and we enjoyed his antics. So it was just like when the USO girls finally came out, though, you couldn't touch him either. Here's more entertainment by the band, and there's some real live surveyors up there because they got an instrument. And the picture there and the guy in the undershirt doesn't belong there because it wasn't on the highway. It was at Juneau. We stopped as we were going up the inside passage. We stopped for a little while, and some of the fellas somehow got to go ashore. He went out in that snowbank, took off his shirt, and I'm sure he mailed it back to show his girlfriend, his mother, and anybody else who wanted to look at it, and here is a day's catch, and the guy standing there with the biggest string, the very first fellow in line, is Humphreys again. One of my favorite pastimes. Well, just pictures of GIs, though I want to comment on the man standing here holding the snowshoe hare. Will you believe his name was pronounced Snare, and it's S-C-H-N-A-R-R-E, Snare, and then, to make a pun, I wonder how he caught that rabbit. Page 8, as pictures from out in the Aleutian Islands, and just so you'll know what it was like, the entertainer there, it was Dr. IQ. If you're old enough to remember the guy that yelled, give that man 20 silver dollars, give that man 30 silver dollars. And you know, I won silver dollars there that night. He asked me a question that I happened to know what a tonsorial artist was, and my stock went up among the boys. That's the end of the commentary on the Alcan Highway. I understand now that it's solid paved road all the way from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks, and that there's service stations possibly every 50 miles. And of course, the wilderness will be no more. I enjoyed, I won't say I enjoyed every minute of it because there were some lonely times, but I learned and I enjoyed a lot of the things that we did and seeing the country. It's something that I wouldn't have missed, but I wouldn't do again for a lot of money.